This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca, iTunes, and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
The medical consequences of eating disorders can go unrecognized, even by experienced clinicians. But early recognition and timely intervention are key to treating eating disorders. We're joined on the phone by Dr. Laird Birmingham, a psychiatrist who specializes in the treatment of eating disorders.
Welcome to People First Radio, Dr. Birmingham.
Thanks, Kevin. Nice to be asked.
Tell us about the process of diagnosing eating disorders. What are the key challenges in diagnosis, and how does it happen?
Well, the diagnosis often isn't made in a timely fashion for a couple of reasons. Firstly, anorexia nervosa, the most worrisome eating disorder, is such an unusual disease in that the patient sort of has two voices within them, almost like a phobia, but the phobia is so scary that they don't recognize it as being anything other than themselves. So they don't tell anybody about it. And even if someone asked, they would often give a story which sounded as if it were normal. So the story may not be there. The second thing is, in our society, weight loss in young women is often something that's applauded. Most of our patients would say, have said to them, gee, you're looking great, or you're losing weight, or what diet are you on, or something like that. And on top of that, many young women have some disordered eating habits. We did a study in Vancouver in three high schools. We found there was a very high prevalence of people at one time or another having, for example, purged or binged. So some of the habits that make up an eating disorder are common, and therefore they might not ring the bell to make the diagnosis.
Now, apparently, early recognition of eating disorders is very important to their eventual treatment. Why is this the case?
Well, as far as anorexia is concerned, the longer the eating disorder goes on, the greater the chance the person has of dying. And I've shown in a 20-year study of patients with anorexia in BC that the patients who would get seen by a specialist like myself in eating disorders dies about 22 years earlier than if they didn't have it. Anorexia, in fact, is the most dangerous of any psychiatric disorder, more dangerous than schizophrenia, bipolar affective disorder, etc. So if we catch them early, they can be treated before they get into that type of scenario. Most people who get serious anorexia, for example, spend at least 7 years in treatment before they get better. Now, if you're a teenager, if you're 17 or 16, 7 years takes you through many of your best, potentially, years, when you're going out, when you're going to school, developing relationships. And if you miss that, that can change your entire life.
Now, parents and guardians are apparently the major frontline help seekers for children and adolescents with eating disorders. Tell us more about the dynamic of parents and guardians and how they might bring the concerns forward to the family doctor.
Well, I think the first thing is to be suspicious. Eating disorders are common. There's no question that a lot of young people just have disordered eating, and they don't want to be overly concerned if for example, someone says they want to become a vegetarian and does that for a bit. But still, they have to be suspicious. And if a young person is losing weight, and that weight loss, there's no reason for it, or it continues, or the young person doesn't want to talk about it, it's sort of secretive, there's a problem. Also, if food is going missing from the house in large amounts, if there is binging and purging, that's another suspicious sign. As well, almost always with eating disorders, there's a change in mood. So if at the same time someone's losing weight or having some changes and they appear to be down or depressed, not seeing their friends, not wanting to go out, that sort of thing, or not being able to sleep, really the bell should ring and they should say, gee, I've got to go to the doctor. Now, because of what I mentioned before, even just taking a young person to the doctor and leaving them there themselves, of course, they may simply deny anything's going wrong. And that's not because they don't want help. A part of this, of course, is that most of society doesn't understand eating disorders. And the vast majority of people simply think they're dieting, people that diet too much, which, of course, is not the case. So when they go to the doctor, I think quite often the parent or guardian would have to at least tell the physician what their concerns are, what they've seen.
Now, in preparing for this interview, I'm using a document prepared by the Academy for Eating Disorders.
Yes.
And out of in a section called Timely Interventions, they note that families need to be helped to understand that they did not cause the illness, neither did their child or family member choose to have it. What are the dynamics there, and how does that present problems?
Well, even though you know, we say that, I'm a fellow of the Academy of Eating Disorders, by the way, but even though we say that and it gets out there, most parents, no matter what happens to their child, feel somewhat guilty. I guess it's sort of a natural thing, isn't it? You know, what could I have done to prevent that? So there's always that level of guilt. And then when you see the doctor, and there are some physicians and others who may believe that perhaps the family was at least somewhat responsible for this. Maybe they were dieting, etc. This sets up a situation where obviously the parent or the guardian can be somewhat defensive about this. And so the whole scenario is difficult. Now, the way we get around that, as you're pointing out, is really education. And the key thing to note is that during the eating disorder, all families have problems. Because any parent who has a child who has leukemia or arthritis or an eating disorder is going to be upset, and they're going to feel bad, and so that end of things is a normal consequence, and that has nothing to do with the genesis of the eating disorders. By the way, anorexia nervosa is basically 100% genetic. You can't get anorexia unless you have the right abnormal genes in your brain. You also have to lose weight and have psychosocial stressors, but anorexia nervosa requires a genetic predisposition that is not related to any family dysfunction. So I think we have to help parents realize that anorexia is a genetic disorder, that they're going to feel bad about this, they're going to feel somewhat guilty as they would with any illness, but really what their child needs. And it's been shown, by the way, that the most important and powerful factor in treating children and adolescents with eating disorders is family therapy. And that's because the child is so dependent on their family for love and support that if the family doesn't understand what's happening and says, for example, just eat, or something like, or, you know, why are you doing this, that can be stop the progress of recovery, even though it wasn't certainly the cause.
Now, you mentioned family therapy as being critical to the success of the treatment of eating disorders. Can you give us a larger picture of treatment? What is it comprised of?
Well, in anorexia nervosa, which always consists of weight loss too, there are several components. The first one is to try to build rapport with the child or adolescent so that they trust the physician and whoever's treating them, because if they don't trust you, it's not going to work. After that, weight restoration, changing their intake of nutrients, because almost all the people we see have changes in their ability to think and remember due to malnutrition, just as we would see in someone who came over from Africa in a malnourished state, and we correct deficiencies. Almost all of these patients, as I mentioned, also have other psychological symptoms like anxiety or depression, and those have to be treated because they're in the same area of the brain where the anorexia is. The anorexia affects the amygdala in the brain, and the binging and purging is in the nucleus accumbens. We actually know where in the brain these things are, where they're a dysfunction of. So we have to correct the depression, for example, or anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder. We also have to work on, in children, the family system, and in adults, often with the couple, with their partner, for example. And a lot of that is simply helping the other individual understand how they can help. Many people, for example, these days will say, should I supervise everything? Should I feed them? Should I, you know, take on the role of a nurse? And the answer is no. They're not the nurse. They're not the doctor. What the patient needs in most cases is love and going to see a movie, or, you know, every time they go for a walk with them. The person needs support, not a nurse. And then if the eating disorder goes on for very long, past a year, and they've missed school for a year, and they've lost their friends and this sort of stuff, they need to get back into life. I think we all know we are our friends who moved in our teens and lost our friends and lost the place. That's enough of a problem right there. But if you lost everything because you're ill, it's much harder. So there needs to be a period of reintroduction into life, getting friends back, learning new hobbies or things that one enjoys.
How successful are eating disorder treatments? And I guess what I'm asking you to do is to comment on relapse and how often that might happen and whether or not that's part of the process.
It is indeed. For anorexia nervosa, relapse is extremely high. More than 50% of people don't get better from anorexia. In bulimia nervosa, it's around 70%. And there's a number of things we should do about relapse at Woodstone. I'm the medical director at Woodstone Residence on Galliano Island. We're reproducing a relapse prevention program that was started by a friend of mine in Germany, Manfred Fichter, which is interestingly an internet-based relapse prevention program, which prevented reduced relapse in Germany, in the entire country and all the programs used, by 70%. Which is incredible. So what this involves is long-term working on some of the things like self-esteem, like physical health, et cetera, in these individuals, recognizing that it isn't a disorder like pneumonia where you're over it and you go out, because there's still the same changes that have occurred in your brain that are still sort of getting better over a long period of time. So you're right, relapse prevention is critical.
Dr. Laird Birmingham, we've run out of time. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us. It was much appreciated.
Thank you for asking me.
Dr. Laird Birmingham is a psychiatrist and the medical director of Woodstone Residence Treatment Center. He's the former medical director of Vancouver's St. Paul's Hospital Eating Disorder Program, was formerly the British Columbia Provincial Director for Eating Disorders, and leader of the BC Eating Disorders Epidemiology Project in the Center for Health Evaluation and Outcome Sciences.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.